Well, folks, here we are for our culture segment, and I have the chance to introduce a new friend to you. He's actually been here at Focus on the Family because he and his wife moved to Colorado Springs, which is really what everyone should do because it's such an amazing place. But his name is Russ Carroll. Russ, welcome.
Thanks, Lisa. I appreciate it.
Great to have you here. And you know, folks, that here at Boundless, whether in articles or on the blog or on the show, we occasionally talk about money. And some of you are ready to run away right now from your iPhone or iPod or whatever you're listening to the show on. But this is going to be good because we are going to pick Russ's brain, tap into his expertise. He has been a financial coach for more than 26 years. He retired from the Dave Ramsey organization, where you helped Dave develop curriculums, walk people through a lot of financial training and coaching. And you were also on his show. So you're a seasoned audio professional as well. And just really has a wealth of knowledge about finances and is going to, in addition to all his work in the realm of finance, he was a singles pastor in Southern California. So he knows and loves our peeps, our generation. So, yeah, so that's really, really cool. We love it when we can find a kindred spirit there. So that's super, super great. So, Russ, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lisa. It's fun to be here. You know, singles. I was 39 before I got married.
Okay.
So I was a singles person for a long time.
Yeah. Okay.
And my wife was 33 when we married. And so this issue of money is something that we all struggle with. It's not just single adults, but we have to be single adults before we get to be couples. And the preparation that you do as a single person carries right over into a relationship. And men and women are wired differently, for sure. And the bigger picture, I think, is that singles, a lot of times, whether they're singles, never been married, singles, been married, not married now, singles, been married, not married with kids, the gamut is large. And I know at the church there in Southern California where I worked initially, single adults, we did a lot of demographics to find out how many singles were there. And it grew quite rapidly to where we had well over 800 single adults. And the big picture there is I always, in premarital counseling or even with the singles, about once or twice a year, I would do something in regards to personal finance because the word budget is a scary word for anyone, but single adults especially, because they're footloose and fancy free. And I've always defined that as a budget is nothing more than telling your money where you'd like it to go rather than wondering where it went. And so reality is that we're influenced tremendously by the environment we live in. And I don't even think we recognize or acknowledge how much we are. Because most of the information we get is either going to be some from observing our parents, you know, peers that we live up and grow up with, or in some cases, the marketing environment that constantly is telling us that we should have this, 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 and this. And we don't think much about it because debt is also a marketed product to us. It says you can have it all now and just pay so much down so much a month, you know, kind of a thing. And so we get caught in that.
So in light of that, what would you say, like if you were talking to the average 20-something young adult, what would you say are a couple of the biggest traps for them to watch out for? Because maybe they're looking at, you know, I mean, now children of the boomers, they're looking at their parents who have all the stuff and they're probably assuming, well, I should have the stuff too, you know, whatever. So what what really are kind of the little sneaky insidious traps that young adults?
Well, the biggest insidious trap is they in freshman year in college when they sit in the registration line and they've got a Visa or a MasterCard table set up by Chase or some other major lender saying, hey, you can get this and you can get a tumbler, you can get a free t-shirt, a cooler of some kind and stuff like that. And then
I have taken the free t-shirt before, Russ, let's be honest. Well, I got the card, I got the t-shirt.
The subtlety is that we're all influenced by that, thinking that this is the next step of independence. Now I'm away at college and, you know, this should be my thing, but no one tells them or explains to them how they work, that they actually have to pay them back with interest, you know? And so the average college student graduates with about $6,000 in credit card debt. Mm-hmm. Besides about $45,000 in student loans today or more.
Yeah.
So it's not, even though the parents may have a lot of stuff and they see that mm-hmm. that wealth or that upper class or middle class mm-hmm. influence,
sure.
doesn't necessarily mean that they're financially healthy.
Yeah.
And so big picture is how do you stop that? Plus the fact that everybody's trying to sell them something all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they want a car. They want clothes, whatever it might be.
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, so then they exit college, then they become, maybe they over projected what their earning power would be based on their first job, and all of a sudden it snowballs because now they have a student loan debt plus consumer debt, and so they're a little bit stuck. What I did want to address a little bit the idea of student debt, just because mm-hmm. not only is that important for the young 20-something who's just out of school, but there are, I have many friends in their 30s and beyond who are still paying off. In fact, I have friends who assume that they'll just be paying school debt till they die because they're never getting ahead. They're not throwing mm-hmm. money at it. And so mm-hmm. how does one keep from being overwhelmed? When you were looking, I mean, it's one thing to think you're paying off $1,000 on some card, but to look at $40,000, something that seems insurmountable.
Right.
How do we break that down into bite-sized pieces?
You know, the adage is you only eat an elephant in the room one bite at a time.
Yeah.
You can't take it all at once. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times there's multiple student loans. Mm-hmm. And so what I try to do is try to have them break down by balance the smallest student loan to the largest.
Okay.
Try to pay the minimums on the smallest. Of course, this doesn't have to happen until about 6 months after graduation mm-hmm. when they have to begin. But if they can begin earlier mm-hmm. because of maybe a quick job situation or something, I would.
Sure.
But the biggest thing, and I can remember speaking to the medical residents at Vanderbilt University,
mm-hmm.
And the big picture was is that they wanted to have everything mom and dad had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because we have that earning potential, it's not there realized yet,
right.
And so they didn't attack the student loans.
Oh, okay.
And so before too long, all of a sudden, these student loans are mm-hmm. massive, mm-hmm. And of course, with going through med school and such. But the reality is that if you can begin to attack the smallest
mm-hmm.
and see traction, mm-hmm. see some progress,
mm-hmm.
see it paid off, and then take what you've been paying there and bring it down.
Okay.
Most student loans are simple interest.
Yeah.
So if you pay more and don't designate it as to principal,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times what happens is it just pays payments ahead.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And it's not really reducing the debt dramatically.
Okay.
And so I think that if they can do that, I have counseled hundreds and hundreds of young students that have basically began to see traction when they actually broke it down to smaller pieces and started biting it one at a time.
Okay. So now let's move out. Let's move to the young professional who maybe is pretty wise in their spending. Maybe they have tackled debt and they're just kind of, in fact, we had one of our bloggers just do a blog post a little while back about how she wished she just got married and how she wished she'd saved more when she was single.
Yeah.
Not that she was super irresponsible or anything like that, but just realizing now with a joint household, with things, she does still have some student loan debt and whatever. What is it common? I mean, I think a lot of young adults or young professionals are told, okay, we'll just set up the 401k, just do, you know, I throw some money under the mattress or in a bank savings account or whatever. What really is the savviest strategy for someone with a limited starting out income to really start putting towards savings? Because I think a lot of young adults are like, that is so far off in the future that I'm going to need to access this. Why even bother? I want stuff now.
Right. Well, I have a 28-year-old daughter, so I understand mm-hmm. dynamic there. I tried to teach her a little bit over early on. But the biggest thing is that men and women are wired differently.
Hmm.
And for a woman, that sense of having some security if there's a bump in the road is really important.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an investment as much as it is an insurance policy against small, minor emergencies that will occur. Could be a flat tire. Mm-hmm. Well, because I have a flat tire, I don't need to go buy another car.
Mm-hmm.
I need to fix the flat tire, you know. And and so the subtlety of that is that if there's a bump in the road, they've got some emergencies. So we always recommend for singles and or married couples to actually begin getting $1,000 in a mini emergency fund.
Mm-hmm.
And with that mini emergency fund, it doesn't cover every possibility, but it gives a little bit of peace of mind to savor that. I call it a security gland
mm-hmm.
that most females mm-hmm. have that men don't understand,
mm-hmm.
you know, so the goal is there to have some emergencies first,
mm-hmm.
savings. If they don't have any, if they have a longer period of time before they begin to think about marriage, then try to build up 3 months of their living expenses in an emergency fund. Then go to retirement planning.
Oh, okay.
Because in long run, that retirement planning will be used again for emergencies if they don't have any cushion.
Yeah.
So I kind of liken it to the cream in an Oreo cookie.
Yeah. Okay.
You have bills.
Yeah.
You've got this little emergency fund and growing maybe.
Yeah.
And then we start putting down more money because mm-hmm. if I don't have to add to the emergency fund all the time, mm-hmm. then I've got more money freed up to be able to address the longer term goal.
Okay.
And it would be good to sit down with somebody and talk through what is that going to look like
yeah.
for me,
yeah.
you know, individually.
So for a millennial person who's looking at like 40, 50 years until retirement, is it, I mean, how can you even know what to do without being super savvy about investments? I mean, is a 401 401k enough, or should you be out there like managing your own portfolios and figuring out
yeah.
that just to me is super, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah. a big part of it is that we're undereducated
yeah.
about money,
okay.
period. And it starts with basics, mm-hmm. learning how to spend properly and healthfully, saving for those non-monthly expenses that we know will occur.
Right.
But when it comes to the long term, I think it's important that we can sit down with somebody that has the heart of a teacher
mm-hmm.
and actually work mm-hmm. on how do you understand this stuff?
Yeah.
What's a mutual fund? What's mm-hmm. a stock? What's a bond? What's a CD? You know, what about real estate? You know, the different kinds of things. I think King Solomon said something that was very helpful. He said, spread your wealth out in 7 or 8 parts because you don't know what disaster may hit the land.
Okay.
So he said, don't put all your eggs in one basket, but
right.
learn.
Right.
And there's a lot of good tools out there
yeah.
That can learn that. I know for myself, I wrote the investment seminar for Dave's company.
Okay.
And in doing that, my goal was to teach them how they work
mm-hmm.
and how you pay, what costs are there, what about returns on the money and stuff like that. When you're thinking long-term
yeah.
retirement, you want to put something in, something that's going to grow, either tax-favored by deferral
yeah.
or tax-free, like a Roth IRA, for instance.
Yeah. Okay. So circling back to spending money and budgeting, here's the thing that I'm sure you hear from young adults all the time. Okay, Russ, there is no way I can do this because I need to have a social life. Okay, mm-hmm. I cannot... I hate the envelope system because it's telling me what to do with my money. You know, it's like, I need to go out for dinner with friends. I need to do coffee dates. How am I going to date and marry someone if I don't have money? How can mm-hmm. I don't want to limit myself. What do you say to that as far as deferred gratification in that sense?
Well, deferred gratification is something that is proposed by many people, but not necessarily lived out.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, instant gratification is the course of our culture. Today is better than tomorrow.
Yeah.
And the subtlety of that is that, but most people that want to do something can do it by naming those dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I have $200 a month set aside for entertainment mm-hmm. and dining out and whatever it's going to be with mm-hmm. my friends and such. They can still tell themselves it's their money.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in right. telling them how to spend their right. money particularly. I'm more interested in principle and saying, you know, if you want to go out and spend time out there, plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to go on a ski trip with some of your single friends and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
Plan that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that may be saving for several months to get there
yeah.
to be able to accomplish that.
Okay.
So it's not restrictive
yeah.
only to the sense that you've got to learn to live on less than you make.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is hard.
What's the balance? Give us a sensible idea or sensible plan of someone, say a young man who wants to get married, but maybe he's getting pressure from his parents that he can't marry unless he has all his debt paid off, all his ducks in a row, in that case, no one's ever going to get married.
Mm-hmm.
So how, and for young women, what should they be looking for? What should this guy prepare for? To what sense should his finances be in order to get married? And to what extent will actually getting married help sure. compound, you know, attacking that kind of stuff? And then for women, you know, what do they need to know? One, evaluating a potential mate, and two, dealing with their own finances and debt moving into marriage.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. It's a broad question because yeah. it covers an awful lot.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is take the time to begin to learn
mm-hmm.
about how money works.
Yeah.
How does it work for you? How does it work for him? In premarital coaching, for me. Mm-hmm. I would always talk about how do we bring this together? Mm-hmm. You know, especially if they're considering or moving in that direction towards marriage. How much debt do you each have? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the goals here? Because I think they need to see. I remember one premarital coaching session that I had where they had not talked about money at all. Mm-hmm. And he had $100,000 as unsecured debt and a mortgage.
Okay.
So he was earning a reasonable amount of money, but he hadn't dressed that, and she didn't even know that. And so I said, and she looked at me when we were talking, the three of us, and she said, what do I do with that? Mm-hmm. I said, well, it happens mm-hmm. that you have to sit down, and your assignment for this week, should you choose to accept it, is to sit down with and see if you combine both households, how would you about to attack that $100,000 of debt?
Right.
Because you don't want to leave it there forever.
Right.
Because then it becomes a pet, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And we like pets, but we don't necessarily like money to be a debt to be a pet to us. And so talking about it and interacting about it is really key. And to be honest, it's an issue of trust. Mm-hmm. If somebody's unwilling to reveal mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. course of a serious developing relationship, then that's a red flag to me.
Yeah.
You know, and I would say, until you guys work on this, I don't know that you're ready to move forward.
Mm-hmm. At what point in a dating relationship would you say a couple should talk about finances generally? And at what point in the relationship should they actually take out budgets and ledgers and look at the nitty gritty?
Well, everybody's different in terms of how fast a relationship develops. Sometimes there's this urge to merge mm-hmm. too quickly, mm-hmm. you know, but I think...
Well, especially if you have debt that you want to unload on someone else.
Yeah.
That's what...
yeah. And that's a trust issue.
yeah.
Because it really comes down to it. So I would suggest that somewhere when they start considering serious really the relationship moving forward, I think it's important that they understand what they're doing for work, mm-hmm. what kind of income are they earning, mm-hmm. you know, and generally, and what kind of debts they have, and how do they manage the resources they have? Do they have anything in savings just for emergencies or cushions like that? But it varies. Mm-hmm. My wife and I... you know, I mean, of course, I was 38 when we met. She was 32. You know, we got married a year and 2 months after we met. Mm-hmm. And we weren't dating initially when we met. Her mom introduced her to me, kind of a thing. But yet we had to talk about that mm-hmm. and had to interact about it. And I thought, well, she's in banking. Mm-hmm. So I thought this would be a great way to build trust in a relationship. Would you like to handle the personal finances? And she said, sure, for a month and a half.
Okay.
And then she came back and said, I think I lied to you. I don't really like the detail of all this.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So I said, you still need money though, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're going to be one in relationship, then we want to do what? We want to combine our resources with a common cash flow plan that says, this is what we both agree on.
Okay.
Rather than one person doing it, the other not. So I think at some point it's going to happen probably within, you know, 6 months to a year before you marry.
Yeah. Okay. Just a last question as we're wrapping up here. I wanted to hop over to the topic of buying a home. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think for a lot of young adults, it's seen as a benchmark. It's mm-hmm. something they want to do. Of course, you know, you coming out of Southern California, it's like nearly impossible.
Yeah.
You talk to young adults there and they're like, that's never going to happen in my lifetime. But where should that be in the goal plan? I mean, should you have all your debt paid off before you enter any kind of mortgage, or what, you know, is that really a wise investment?
A mortgage is always the dream. It's the part of the American dream,
right?
You know, in America. The reality is, though, is most people just have this urge to buy.
Yeah.
And it overwhelms them, and they have no emergency savings at all, and they get into a house, and all of a sudden you've got upkeep and maintenance, you've got different things that are going to cap in property taxes, insurance, which is higher than renters if they have mm-hmm. renters insurance. So I usually recommend that they have somewhere around 20% down payment mm-hmm. to actually get into a home. Now, you can get in for less, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but too oftentimes it's a 30-year mortgage. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, well, why should I shy away from a 30-year mortgage. Well, in reality, the difference between a 15 and a 30-year mortgage, putting 20% down, is probably more than $100,000 to $200,000 of interest paid in that you wouldn't have to do of hard-earned money.
Right.
So I usually recommend think about that. I mean, you're going to do what you're going to do.
Sure.
But the reality is maybe it's not the right time, and it's not hurtful to wait.
Right.
I bought my first house at 39. I rented inexpensively. In fact, I had a friend that rented me his house on the beach in Newport Beach for $100 a month. But but that's rare.
None of us need to hear that, Russ.
That's very rare.
Very rare.
But the fact of the matter is when we did, we put enough down so that we had a small mortgage and a reasonable payment that was well within both of our incomes. And we recommend that it's the mortgage payment itself is not much more than 25% of your combined take home.
Okay. All right. Well, those are good thoughts. Thanks for letting me hop all over the map there. So, just quickly, like any, like a person who's like, I want to hit the ground running. I need to get a budget. Never done that. What next step? Any tools you'd recommend?
Take out a piece of paper and write down what you anticipate your expenses are going to be.
Okay.
And then fine tune it.
Yep.
But don't leave out non-monthly expenses.
Right. Okay.
Because, for instance, Christmas doesn't come every year.
Yeah.
And if you're a giving person, you want to give your parents, break it down what you think you can afford based on that to a monthly amount, and then try to save that amount.
Yeah.
Same thing with if you pay car insurance every 6 months, or if you decide to go on a vacation, you want to do a fun vacation or two. Plan out how much you think you can afford to spend and break it down to a monthly amount and add that into the budget to see whether your income and your total expenses with both fixed and variable expenses that happen every month.
Sure.
And those non-monthly expenses fit within your income stream.
Okay, good points. Russ Carroll, everyone, we appreciate your super advice for us. Thanks for being part of this.
Thanks, Lisa. I appreciate being here.